It will be a splendid session.
101. The Apparition. As the Procureur du Roi had told Madame Danglars, Valentine was not yet recovered. Bowed down with fatigue, she was indeed confined to her bed, and it was in her own room and from the lips of Madame de Villefort that she heard all the strange events we have related. We mean the flight of Eugénie and the arrest of Andrea Cavalcanti, or rather Benedetto, together with the accusation of murder pronounced against him. But Valentine was so weak that this recital scarcely produced the same effect it would have done had she been in her usual state of health. Indeed, her brain was only the seat of vague ideas, and confused forms mingled with strange fancies alone presented themselves before her eyes. During the daytime, Valentine's perceptions remained tolerably clear, owing to the constant presence of Monsieur Noirtier, who caused himself to be carried to his granddaughter's room and watched her with his paternal tenderness. Villefort also, on his return from the palais, frequently passed an hour or two with his father and child. At 6 o'clock, Villefort retired to his study. At 8, Monsieur d'Avrigny arrived himself, bringing the night draught prepared for the young girl, and then Monsieur Noirtier was carried away. A nurse of the doctor's choice succeeded them, and never left till about 10 or 11 o'clock, when Valentine was asleep. As she went downstairs, she gave the keys of Valentine's room to Monsieur de Villefort, so that no one could reach the sick room, excepting through that of Madame de Villefort and little Edouard. Every morning Morel called on Noirtier to receive news of Valentine, and, extraordinary as it seemed, each day found him less uneasy. Certainly, though Valentine still laboured under dreadful nervous excitement, she was better, and moreover Monte Cristo had told him when, half distracted, he had rushed to his house, that if she was not dead in 2 hours, she was saved. Now 4 days had elapsed, and Valentine still lived. The nervous excitement of which we speak pursued Valentine even in her sleep, or rather in that state of somnolence which succeeded her waking hours. It was then in the silence of night, in the dim light shed from the alabaster lamp on the chimney-piece, that she saw those shadows pass and repass, which hover over the bed of sickness and fan the fever with their trembling wings. First, she fancied she saw her stepmother threatening her. Then Morel stretched his arms towards her. Sometimes mere strangers, like the Count of Monte Cristo, appeared to visit her. Even the very furniture in these moments of delirium seemed to move. And this state lasted till about 3 o'clock in the morning, when a deep, heavy slumber overcame the young girl, from which she did not awake till morning. On the evening of the day on which Valentine had learnt of the flight of Eugénie and the arrest of Benedetto, Villefort, having retired as well as Noirtier and d'Avrigny, her thoughts wandered in a confused maze, alternately reviewing her own situation and the events she had just heard. 11 o'clock had struck. The nurse, having placed the beverage prepared by the doctor within reach of the patient and locked the door, was listening with terror to the comments of the servants in the kitchen, and storing her memory with all the horrible stories which had for some months past amused the occupants of the antechambers in the house of the Procureur du Roi. Meanwhile, an unexpected scene was passing in the room which had been so carefully locked. 10 minutes had elapsed since the nurse had left. Valentine, who for the last hour had been suffering from the fever which returned nightly, incapable of controlling her ideas, was forced to yield to the excitement which exhausted itself in producing and reproducing a succession and recurrence of the same fancies and images. The night lamp threw out countless rays, each resolving itself into some strange form to her disordered imagination, when suddenly, by its flickering light, Valentine thought she saw the door of her library, which was in the recess by the chimney-piece, open slowly, though she in vain listened for the sound of the hinges on which it turned. At any other time, Valentine would have seized the silken bell-pull and summoned assistance, but nothing astonished her in her present situation. Her reason told her that all the visions she beheld were but the children of her imagination, and the conviction was strengthened by the fact that, in the morning, no traces remained of the nocturnal phantoms who disappeared with the daylight. From behind the door, a human figure appeared, but she was too familiar with such apparitions to be alarmed, and therefore only stared, hoping to recognize Morel. The figure advanced towards the bed and appeared to listen with profound attention. At this moment a ray of light glanced across the face of the midnight visitor. "It is not he," she murmured, and waited in the assurance of its being but a dream for the man to disappear or assume some other form. Still she felt her pulse, and finding it throbbed violently, she remembered that the best method of dispelling such illusions was to drink, for a draught of the beverage prepared by the doctor to allay her fever seemed to cause a reaction of the brain, and for a short time she suffered less. Valentine therefore reached her hand towards the glass, but as soon as her trembling arm left the bed, the apparition advanced more quickly towards her and approached the young girl so closely that she fancied she heard his breath and felt the pressure of his hand. This time the illusion, or rather the reality, surpassed anything Valentine had before experienced. She began to believe herself really alive and awake, and the belief that her reason was this time not deceived made her shudder. The pressure she felt was evidently intended to arrest her arm, and she slowly withdrew it. Then the figure, from whom she could not detach her eyes, and who appeared more protecting than menacing, took the glass and, walking towards the nightlight, held it up, as if to test its transparency. This did not seem sufficient. The man, or rather the phantom, for he trod so softly that no sound was heard, then poured out about a spoonful into the glass and drank it. Valentine witnessed this scene with a sentiment of stupefaction. Every minute she had expected that it would vanish and give place to another vision, but the man, instead of dissolving like a shadow, again approached her and said in an agitated voice, "Now you may drink." Valentine shuddered. It was the first time one of these visions had ever addressed her in a living voice, and she was about to utter an exclamation. The man placed his finger on her lips. "The Count of Monte Cristo," she murmured. It was easy to see that no doubt now remained in the young girl's mind as to the reality of the scene. Her eyes started with terror, her hands trembled, and she rapidly drew her bedclothes closer to her. Still, the presence of Monte Cristo at such an hour, his mysterious, fanciful, and extraordinary entrance into her room through the wall, might well seem impossibilities to her shattered reason. "Do not call anyone. Do not be alarmed," said the Count. "Do not let a shade of suspicion or uneasiness remain in your breast. The man standing before you, Valentine, for this time it is no phantom, is nothing more than the tenderest father and the most respectful friend you could dream of." Valentine could not reply. The voice which indicated the real presence of a being in the room alarmed her so much that she feared to utter a syllable. Still the expression of her eyes seemed to inquire, "If your intentions are pure, why are you here?" The Count's marvellous sagacity understood all that was passing in the young girl's mind. "Listen to me," he said, "or rather, look upon me. Look at my face, paler even than usual, and my eyes red with weariness. For 4 days I have not closed them, for I have been constantly watching you to protect and preserve you for Maximilian." The blood mounted rapidly to the cheeks of Valentine, for the name just pronounced by the Count dispelled all the fear with which his presence had inspired her. "Maximilian!" she exclaimed, and so sweet did the sound appear to her that she repeated it. "Maximilian! Has he then owned all to you?"
"Everything. He told me your life was his, and I have promised him you shall live."
"You have promised him that I shall live?"
"Yes.
But, sir, you spoke of vigilance and protection. Are you a doctor?"
"Yes.
the best you could have at the present time, believe me.
But you say you have watched, said Valentine uneasily. Where have you been? I have not seen you.
The Count extended his hand towards the library. I was hidden behind that door, he said, which leads into the next house, which I have rented. Valentine turned her eyes away, and with an indignant expression of pride and modest fear, exclaimed,
Sir, I think you have been guilty of an unparalleled intrusion, and that which you call protection is more resembling an insult.
Valentine, he answered, during my long watch over you, all I have observed has been what people visited you, what nourishment was prepared, and what beverage was served. Then, when the latter appeared dangerous to me, I entered, as I have now done, and substituted in the place of the poison a healthy draught, which, instead of producing the death intended, caused life to circulate in your veins.
Poison? Death?
Exclaimed Valentine, half believing herself under the influence of some feverish hallucination.
What are you saying, sir?
Hush, my child, said Monte Cristo, again placing his finger upon her lips. I did say poison and death, but drink some of this. And the Count took a bottle from his pocket containing a red liquid, of which he poured a few drops into the glass. Drink this, and then take nothing more tonight. Valentine stretched out her hand, but scarcely had she touched the glass than she drew back in fear. Monte Cristo took the glass and drank half its contents, and then presented it to Valentine, who smiled and swallowed the rest.
Oh, yes, she exclaimed. I recognize the flavor of my nocturnal beverage, which refreshed me so much, and seemed to ease my aching brain. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
This is how you have lived during the last 4 nights, Valentine, said the Count. But oh, how I pass that time! Oh, the wretched hours I have endured, the torture to which I have submitted when I saw the deadly poison poured into your glass, and how I trembled lest you would drink it before I could find time to throw it away.
Sir, said Valentine at the height of her terror, you say you endured tortures when you saw the deadly poison poured into my glass. But if you saw this, you must also have seen the person who poured it.
Yes. Valentine raised herself in bed and drew over her chest, which appeared whiter than snow, the embroidered cambric, still moist with the cold dews of delirium, to which were now added those of terror.
You saw the person? Repeated the young girl.
Yes, repeated the Count.
That which you tell me is horrible, sir. You wish to make me believe something too dreadful. What? Attempt to murder me in my father's house? In my room? On my bed of sickness? Oh, leave me, sir. You are tempting me. You make me doubt the goodness of Providence. It is impossible. It cannot be.
Are you the first that this hand has stricken? Have you not seen Monsieur de Saint-Marin, Madame de Saint-Marin, Barrois, all fall? Would not Monsieur Noirtier also have fallen a victim, had not the treatment he has been pursuing for the last 3 years neutralized the effects of the poison?
Oh, heaven, said Valentine, is this the reason why Grandpapa has made me share all his beverages during the last month?
And have they all tasted of a slightly bitter flavor, like that of dried orange peel?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Then that explains all, said Monte Cristo. Your grandfather knows, then, that a poisoner lives here. Perhaps he even suspects the person. He has been fortifying you, his beloved child, against the fatal effects of the poison, which would have failed from the constant habit of imbibing it. But even this would have availed little against a more deadly medium of death employed 4 days ago, which is generally but too fatal.
But Who, then, is this assassin, this murderer?
Let me also ask you a question. Have you never seen anyone enter your room at night?
Oh, yes. I have frequently seen shadows pass close to me, approach and disappear. But I took them for visions raised by my feverish imagination. And indeed, when you entered, I thought I was under the influence of delirium.
And you do not know who it is that attempts your life?
No, said Valentine. Who could desire my death?
You shall know it now, then, said Monte Cristo, listening.
How do you mean?
Said Valentine, looking terrified around. Because you are not feverish or delirious tonight, but thoroughly awake. Midnight is striking, which is the hour murderers choose.
Oh, heavens!
Exclaimed Valentine, wiping off the drops which ran down her forehead. Midnight struck slowly and sadly. Every hour seemed to strike with leaden weight upon the heart of the poor girl.
Valentine, said the Count, summon up all your courage. Still the beatings of your heart. Do not let a sound escape you, and feign to be asleep. Then you will see.
Valentine seized the Count's hand.
I think I hear a noise, she said. Leave me.
Goodbye for the present, replied the Count, walking upon tiptoe towards the library door, and smiling with an expression so sad and paternal that the young girl's heart was filled with gratitude. Before closing the door, he turned round once more and said,
Not a movement, not a word. Let them think you asleep, or perhaps you may be killed before I have the power of helping you.
And with this fearful injunction, the Count disappeared through the door, which noiselessly closed after him. 102. The Serpent. Valentine was alone. Two other clocks, slower than that of Saint-Philippe du Roule, struck the hour of midnight from different situations, and excepting the rumbling of a few carriages, all was silent. Then Valentine's attention was engrossed by the clock in her room, which marked the seconds. She began counting them, remarking that they were much slower than the beatings of her heart. And still she doubted. The inoffensive Valentine could not imagine anyone desiring her death. Why should they? To what end? What had she done to excite the malice of an enemy? There was no fear of her falling asleep. One terrible idea pressed upon her mind, that someone existed in the world who had attempted to assassinate her and who was about to endeavour to do so again. Supposing this person, wearied at the inefficiency of the poison, should, as Monte Cristo said, have recourse to steel. What if the Count should have no time to run to her rescue? What if her last moments were approaching and she would never again see Morel? When this terrible chain of ideas presented itself, Valentine was nearly persuaded to ring the bell and call for help. But through the door, she fancied she saw the luminous eye of the Count, that eye which lived in her memory, and the recollection overwhelmed her with so much shame that she asked herself whether any amount of gratitude could ever repay his dangerous and devoted friendship. 20 minutes, 20 tedious minutes passed thus, then 10 more, and at last the clock struck the half hour. Just then the sound of fingernails slightly grating against the door of the library informed Valentine that the Count was still watching and recommended her to do the same. At the same time, on the opposite side, that is, towards Edouard's room, Valentine fancied she heard the creaking of the floor. She listened attentively, holding her breath till she was nearly suffocated. The lock turned, and the door slowly opened. Valentine had raised herself upon her elbow, and had scarcely time to throw herself down on the bed and shade her eyes with her arm. Then, trembling, agitated, and her heart beating with indescribable terror, she awaited the event. Someone approached the bed and drew back the curtains. Valentine summoned every effort, and breathed with that regular respiration which announces tranquil sleep.
Valentine, said a low voice.
Still silent. Valentine had promised not to wake. Then everything remained still, excepting that Valentine heard the almost noiseless sound of some liquid being poured into the glass she had just emptied. Then she ventured to open her eyelids and glance over her extended arm. She saw a female in a white dressing gown pouring a liquor from a phial into her glass. During this short time, Valentine must have held her breath or moved in some slight degree, for the woman, disturbed, stopped and leaned over the bed in order the better to ascertain whether Valentine slept. It was Madame de Villefort. On recognizing her stepmother, Valentine could not repress a shudder which caused a vibration in the bed. Madame de Villefort instantly stepped back close to the wall, and there, shaded by the bed curtains, she silently and attentively watched the slightest movement of Valentine. The latter recollected the terrible caution of Monte Cristo. She fancied that the hand not holding the phial clasped a long, sharp knife. Then, collecting all her remaining strength, she forced herself to close her eyes. But this simple operation upon the most delicate organs of our frame, generally so easy to accomplish, became almost impossible at this moment, so much did curiosity struggle to retain the eyelid open and learn the truth. Madame de Villefort, however, reassured by the silence which was alone disturbed by the regular breathing of Valentine, again extended her hand, and, half hidden by the curtains, succeeded in emptying the contents of the phial into the glass. Then she retired so gently that Valentine did not know she had left the room. She only witnessed the withdrawal of the arm, that fair, round arm of a woman but 25 years old, and who yet spread death around her. It is impossible to describe the sensations experienced by Valentine during the minute and a half Madame de Villefort remained in the room. The grating against the library door roused the young girl from the state of stupor in which she was plunged, and which almost amounted to insensibility. She raised her head with an effort. The noiseless door again turned on its hinges, and the Count of Monte Cristo reappeared. "Well," said he, "do you still doubt?" "Oh," murmured the young girl. "Have you seen?"
"Alas!"
"Did you recognize?" Valentine groaned.
"Oh, yes," she said. "I saw. But I cannot believe."
"Would you rather die then and cause Maximilian's death?"
"Oh," repeated the young girl, almost bewildered, "can I not leave the house? Can I not escape?"
"Valentine, the hand which now threatens you will pursue you everywhere. Your servants will be seduced with gold, and death will be offered to you, disguised in every shape. You will find it in the water you drink from the spring, in the fruit you pluck from the tree. But did you not say that my kind grandfather's precaution had neutralized the poison?"
"Yes, but not against a strong dose. The poison will be changed and the quantity increased."
He took the glass and raised it to his lips. "It is already done," he said. "Brucine is no longer employed, but a simple narcotic. I can recognize the flavor of the alcohol in which it has been dissolved. If you had taken that which Madame de Villefort has poured into your glass, Valentine, you would have been lost."
"But," exclaimed the young girl, "why am I thus pursued? How? Are you so kind, so good, so unsuspicious of ill, that you cannot understand Valentine? No. I have never injured her."
"But you are rich, Valentine. You have 200,000 livres a year, and you prevent her son from enjoying these 200,000 livres.
"How so? The fortune is not her gift, but is inherited from my relations."
"Certainly. And this is why Monsieur and Madame de Saint-Marin have died. This is why Monsieur Noirtier was sentenced the day he made you his heir. This is why you, in turn, are to die. It is because your father would inherit your property, and your brother, his only son, succeed to his.
Edouard? Poor child! Are all these crimes committed on his account?
Ah, then you at length understand.
Heaven grant that this may not be visited upon him.
Valentine, you are an angel.
But why is my grandfather allowed to live?
It was considered that you dead, the fortune would naturally revert to your brother, unless he were disinherited. And besides, the crime appearing useless, it would be folly to commit it.
And is it possible that this frightful combination of crimes has been invented by a woman?
Do you recollect, in the arbor of the Hôtel des Postes at Perusa, seeing a man in a brown cloak, whom your stepmother was questioning upon Acqua Tofana? Well, ever since then, the infernal project has been ripening in her brain.
Ah, then indeed, sir, said the sweet girl, bathed in tears, I see that I am condemned to die.
No, Valentine, for I have foreseen all their plots. No, your enemy is conquered since we know her, and you will live, Valentine, live to be happy yourself, and to confer happiness upon a noble heart. But to ensure this, you must rely on me.
Command me, sir. What am I to do?
You must blindly take what I give you.
Alas, were it only for my own sake, I should prefer to die.
You must not confide in anyone, not even in your father.
My father is not engaged in this fearful plot, is he, sir?
Asked Valentine, clasping her hands. No. And yet your father, a man accustomed to judicial accusations, ought to have known that all these deaths have not happened naturally. It is he who should have watched over you. He should have occupied my place. He should have emptied that glass. He should have risen against the assassin.
Spectre against spectre,
he murmured in a low voice as he concluded his sentence.
Sir, said Valentine, I will do all I can to live, for there are two beings whose existence depends upon mine, my grandfather and Maximilian.
I will watch over them as I have over you.
Well, sir, do as you will with me.
And then she added in a low voice,
Oh, heavens, what will befall me?
Whatever may happen, Valentine, do not be alarmed. Though you suffer, though you lose sight, hearing, consciousness, fear nothing. Though you should awake and be ignorant where you are, still do not fear. Even though you should find yourself in a sepulchral vault or coffin, reassure yourself then and reflect. At this moment a friend, a father, who lives for my happiness and that of Maximilian, watches over me.
Alas! Alas, what a fearful extremity,
Valentine. Would you rather denounce your stepmother?
I would rather die 100 times. Oh, yes, die.
No, you will not die. But will you promise me, whatever happens, that you will not complain, but hope?
I will think of Maximilian.
My child, believe in my devotion to you, as you believe in the goodness of Providence and the love of Maximilian. Then he drew from his waistcoat pocket the little emerald box, raised the golden lid, and took from it a pastille about the size of a pea, which he placed in her hand. She took it and looked attentively on the Count. There was an expression on the face of her intrepid protector which commanded her veneration. She evidently interrogated him by her look.
Yes, said he.
Valentine carried the pastille to her mouth and swallowed it.
And now, my dear child, adieu for the present. I will try and gain a little sleep, for you are saved.
Go, said Valentine.
Whatever happens, I promise you not to fear.
Monte Cristo for some time kept his eyes fixed on the young girl, who gradually fell asleep, yielding to the effects of the narcotic the Count had given her. Then he took the glass, emptied 3 parts of the contents in the fireplace, that it might be supposed Valentine had taken it, and replaced it on the table. Then he disappeared, after throwing a farewell glance on Valentine, who slept with the confidence and innocence of an angel. 103. Valentine. The nightlight continued to burn on the chimney-piece, exhausting the last drops of oil which floated on the surface of the water. A dull and dismal light was shed over the bedclothes and curtains surrounding the young girl. All noise in the streets had ceased, and the silence was frightful. It was then that the door of Edouard's room opened, and a head we have before noticed appeared in the glass opposite. It was Madame de Villefort, who came to witness the effects of the draught. She stopped in the doorway, listened for a moment to the flickering of the lamp, the only sound in that deserted room, and then advanced to the table to see if Valentine's glass were empty. It was still about a quarter full, as we before stated. Madame de Villefort emptied the contents into the ashes, which she disturbed that they might the more readily absorb the liquid. Then she carefully rinsed the glass, and wiping it with her handkerchief, replaced it on the table. If anyone could have looked into the room just then, he would have noticed the hesitation with which Madame de Villefort approached the bed and looked fixedly on Valentine. The dim light, the profound silence, and the gloomy thoughts inspired by the hour, and still more by her own conscience, all combined to produce a sensation of fear. The poisoner was terrified to contemplate her own work. At length she rallied, drew aside the curtain, and, leaning over the pillow, gazed intently on Valentine. The young girl no longer breathed. No breath issued through the half-closed teeth. The white lips no longer quivered. The eyes appeared floating in a bluish vapour, and the long black lashes rested on a cheek white as wax. Madame de Villefort gazed upon the face, so expressive even in its stillness. Then she ventured to raise the coverlet and press her hand upon the young girl's heart. It was cold and motionless. She only felt the pulsation in her own fingers and withdrew her hand with a shudder. One arm was hanging out of the bed, that beautiful arm which seemed moulded by a sculptor, but the other appeared slightly distorted by convulsion, and the hand, so delicately formed, was resting with stiff and outstretched fingers on the framework of the bed. The nails, too, were turning blue. Madame de Villefort had no longer any doubt. All was over. She had consummated the last terrible work she had to accomplish. There was no more to do in the room, so the poisoner retired stealthily, as though fearing to hear the sound of her own footsteps. But as she withdrew, she still held aside the curtain, absorbed in the irresistible attraction always offered by the picture of death, so long as it remains merely mysterious, without exciting disgust. Just then the lamp again flickered. The noise startled Madame de Villefort, who shuddered and dropped the curtain. Immediately afterwards the light expired, and the room was plunged in terrible obscurity while the clock at that minute struck 4:30. Overpowered with agitation, the poisoner succeeded in groping her way to the door and reached her room in an agony of fear. The darkness lasted 2 hours longer. Then, by degrees, a cold light crept through the Venetian blinds, until at length it revealed the objects in the room. About this time the nurse's cough was heard on the stairs, and the woman entered the room with a cup in her hand. To the tender eye of a father or a lover, the first glance would have sufficed to convince them of Valentine's state, but to this hireling Valentine only appeared to sleep. "Good," she exclaimed, approaching the table. "She has taken part of her draught. The glass is 3/4 empty." Then she went to the fireplace and lit the fire, and, although she had but just left the bed, she could not resist the temptation offered by Valentine's sleep, so she threw herself into an armchair to snatch a little more rest. The clock, striking 8, awoke her. astonished at the prolonged sleep of the patient, and frightened to see that the arm was still hanging out of bed, she advanced towards Valentine, and for the first time noticed the white lips. She tried to replace the arm, but it moved with a frightful stiffness which could not deceive a sick nurse. She screamed aloud, then, running to the door, exclaimed, "Help! Help!" "What do you mean?" asked Monsieur d'Avrigny at the foot of the stairs, it being the hour he usually visited her. "What do you mean?" asked Fifo, rushing from his room. "Doctor, do you hear them call for help?" "Yes, yes, let us hasten up. It was in Valentine's room." But before the doctor and the father could reach the room, the servants who were on the same floor had entered, and seeing Valentine pale and motionless on her bed, they lifted up their hands towards heaven and stood transfixed, as though struck by lightning.
"Call Madame de Villefort! Wake Madame de Villefort!"
cried the procureur du roi, from the door of his chamber, which it seemed he scarcely dared to leave. But instead of obeying him, the servants stood watching Monsieur d'Avrigny, who ran to Valentine and raised her in his arms.
"What? This one, too?" he exclaimed. "Oh, when will this cease?"
Fifo rushed into the room.
"What are you saying, doctor?" he exclaimed, raising his hand to heaven.
"I say that Valentine is dead," replied d'Avrigny, in a voice terrible in its solemn calmness.
Monsieur de Villefort staggered and buried his head in the bed. On the exclamation of the doctor and the cry of the father, the servants all fled with muttered imprecations. They were heard running down the stairs and through the long passages. Then there was a rush in the court. Afterwards, all was still. They had, one and all, deserted from the accursed house. Just then, Madame de Villefort, in the act of slipping on her dressing gown, threw aside the drapery, and for a moment remained still, as though interrogating the occupants of the room, while she endeavoured to call up some rebellious tears. On a sudden, she stepped, or rather bounded, with outstretched arms towards the table. She saw d'Avrigny curiously examining the glass, which she felt certain of having emptied during the night. It was now a third full, just as it was when she threw the contents into the ashes. The spectre of Valentine, rising before the poisoner, would have alarmed her less. It was, indeed, the same colour as the draught she had poured into the glass and which Valentine had drunk. It was, indeed, the poison which could not deceive Monsieur d'Avrigny, which he now examined so closely. It was, doubtless, a miracle from heaven that, notwithstanding her precautions, there should be some trace, some proof remaining to denounce the crime. While Madame de Villefort remained rooted to the spot like a statue of terror, and Villefort, with his head hidden in the bedclothes, saw nothing around him, d'Avrigny approached the window that he might the better examine the contents of the glass, and dipping the tip of his finger in, tasted it.
"Ah," he exclaimed, "it is no longer brucine that is used. Let me see what it is."
Then he ran to one of the cupboards in Valentine's room, which had been transformed into a medicine closet, and taking from its silver case a small bottle of nitric acid, dropped a little of it into the liquor, which immediately changed to a blood-red colour.
"Ah!"
exclaimed d'Avrigny, in a voice in which the horror of a judge unveiling the truth was mixed with the delight of a student discovering a problem. Madame de Villefort was overpowered. Her eyes first flashed and then swam. She staggered towards the door and disappeared. Directly afterwards, the distant sound of a heavy weight falling on the ground was heard, but no one paid any attention to it. The nurse was engaged in watching the chemical analysis, and Villefort was still absorbed in grief. Monsieur d'Avrigny alone had followed Madame de Villefort with his eyes and watched her precipitate retreat. He lifted up the drapery over the entrance to Edouard's room, and his eye, reaching as far as Madame de Villefort's apartment, he beheld her extended, lifeless, on the floor. "Go to the assistance of Madame de Villefort," he said to the nurse. "Madame de Villefort is ill."
"But Mademoiselle de Villefort," stammered the nurse.
"Mademoiselle de Villefort no longer requires help," said d'Avrigny, "since she is dead."
"Dead!
Dead!" groaned forth Villefort in a paroxysm of grief which was the more terrible from the novelty of the sensation in the iron heart of that man.
"Dead?
repeated a third voice. "Who said Valentine was dead?" The two men turned round and saw Morel standing at the door, pale and terror-stricken. This is what had happened. At the usual time, Morel had presented himself at the little door leading to Noirtier's room. Contrary to custom, the door was open, and having no occasion to ring, he entered. He waited for a moment in the hall and called for a servant to conduct him to Monsieur Noirtier, but no one answered, the servants having, as we know, deserted the house. Morel had no particular reason for uneasiness. Monte Cristo had promised him that Valentine should live, and, until then, he had always fulfilled his word. Every night the Count had given him news, which was the next morning confirmed by Noirtier. Still, this extraordinary silence appeared strange to him, and he called a second and a third time. Still, no answer. Then he determined to go up. Noirtier's room was open like all the rest. The first thing he saw was the old man sitting in his armchair in his usual place, but his eyes expressed an internal fright, which was confirmed by the pallor which overspread his features. "How are you, sir?" asked Morel, with a sickness of heart. "Well," answered the old man by closing his eyes, but his appearance manifested increasing uneasiness. "You are thoughtful, sir," continued Morel. "You want something. Shall I call one of the servants?" "Yes," replied Noirtier. Morel pulled the bell, but though he nearly broke the cord, no one answered. He turned towards Noirtier. The pallor and anguish expressed on his countenance momentarily increased. "Oh," exclaimed Morel, "why do they not come? Is anyone ill in the house?" The eyes of Noirtier seemed as though they would start from their sockets. "What is the matter? You alarm me. Valentine? Valentine?" "Yes. Yes," sighed Noirtier. Maximilian tried to speak, but he could articulate nothing. He staggered and supported himself against the wainscot. Then he pointed to the door. "Yes, yes, yes," continued the old man. Maximilian rushed up the little staircase while Noirtier's eyes seemed to say, "Quicker, quicker." In a minute the young man darted through several rooms till at length he reached Valentine's. There was no occasion to push the door. It was wide open. A sob was the only sound he heard. He saw, as though in a mist, a black figure kneeling and buried in a confused mass of white drapery. A terrible fear transfixed him. It was then he heard a voice exclaim, "Valentine is dead," and another voice which, like an echo, repeated, "Dead. Dead."
104. Maximilian. Fifor rose, half ashamed of being surprised in such a paroxysm of grief. The terrible office he had held for 25 years had succeeded in making him more or less than man. His glance, at first wandering, fixed itself upon Morel.
"Who are you, sir?" he asked, "that forget that this is not the manner to enter a house stricken with death. Go, sir, go."
But Morel remained motionless. He could not detach his eyes from that disordered bed and the pale corpse of the young girl who was lying on it.
"Go, do you hear?" said Vifor, while d'Avrigny advanced to lead Morel out.
Maximilian stared for a moment at the corpse, gazed all round the room, then upon the two men. He opened his mouth to speak, but finding it impossible to give utterance to the innumerable ideas that occupied his brain, he went out, thrusting his hands through his hair in such a manner that Vifor and d'Avrigny, for a moment diverted from the engrossing topic, exchanged glances which seemed to convey, "He is mad." But in less than 5 minutes the staircase groaned beneath an extraordinary weight. Morel was seen carrying, with superhuman strength, the armchair containing Noirtier upstairs. When he reached the landing, he placed the armchair on the floor and rapidly rolled it into Valentine's room. This could only have been accomplished by means of unnatural strength supplied by powerful excitement. But the most fearful spectacle was Noirtier being pushed towards the bed, his face expressing all his meaning, and his eyes supplying the want of every other faculty. That pale face and flaming glance appeared to Vifor like a frightful apparition. Each time he had been brought into contact with his father, something terrible had happened.
"See what they have done," cried Morel, with one hand leaning on the back of the chair and the other extended towards Valentine. "See, my father, see."
Vifor drew back and looked with astonishment on the young man, who, almost a stranger to him, called Noirtier his father. At this moment, the whole soul of the old man seemed centered in his eyes, which became bloodshot. The veins of the throat swelled. His cheeks and temples became purple, as though he were struck with epilepsy. Nothing was wanting to complete this but the utterance of a cry, and the cry issued from his pores, if we may thus speak, a cry frightful in its silence. D'Avrigny rushed towards the old man and made him inhale a powerful restorative.
"Sir," cried Morel, seizing the moist hand of the paralytic, "they ask me who I am and what right I have to be here. Oh, you know it. Tell them. Tell them."
And the young man's voice was choked by sobs. As for the old man, his chest heaved with his panting respiration. One could have thought he was undergoing the agonies preceding death. At length, happier than the young man, who sobbed without weeping, tears glistened in the eyes of Noirtier.
"Tell them," said Morel in a hoarse voice, "tell them I am her betrothed. Tell them she was my beloved, my noble girl, my only blessing in the world. Tell them, oh, tell them, that corpse belongs to me."
The young man, who presented the dreadful spectacle of a strong frame crushed, fell heavily on his knees before the bed, which his fingers grasped with convulsive energy. D'Avrigny, unable to bear the sight of this touching emotion, turned away, and Vifor, without seeking any further explanation, and attracted towards him by the irresistible magnetism which draws us towards those who have loved the people for whom we mourn, extended his hand towards the young man. But Morel saw nothing. He had grasped the hand of Valentine, and, unable to weep, vented his agony in gnawing the sheets. For some time nothing was heard in that chamber but sobs, exclamations, and prayers. At length Vifor, the most composed of all, spoke.
"Sir," said he to Maximilian, "you say you loved Valentine, that you were betrothed to her. I knew nothing of this engagement, of this love, yet I, her father, forgive you, for I see your grief is real and deep, and besides, my own sorrow is too great for anger to find a place in my heart. But you see, the angel whom you hoped for has left this earth. She has nothing more to do with the adoration of men. Take a last farewell, sir, of her sad remains. Take the hand you expected to possess once more within your own, and then separate yourself from her forever. Valentine now alone requires the priest, who will bless her." "You are mistaken, sir," exclaimed Morel, raising himself on one knee, his heart pierced by a more acute pang than any he had yet felt. "You are mistaken. Valentine, dying as she has, not only requires a priest, but an avenger. You, Monsieur de Vifor, send for the priest. I will be the avenger." "What do you mean, sir?" asked Vifor, trembling at the new idea inspired by the delirium of Morel. "I tell you, sir, that two persons exist in you. The father has mourned sufficiently. Now let the procureur du roi fulfill his office."
The eyes of Noirtier glistened, and D'Avrigny approached.
"Gentlemen," said Morel, reading all that passed through the minds of the witnesses to the scene, "I know what I am saying, and you know as well as I do what I am about to say.
Valentin has been assassinated. Vifor hung his head. Davrini approached nearer, and Noirtier expressed yes with his eyes. Now, sir, continued Morel, in these days no one can disappear by violent means without some inquiries being made as to the cause of her disappearance, even were she not a young, beautiful, and adorable creature like Valentine. Monsieur le Procureur du Roi, said Morel with increasing vehemence, no mercy is allowed. I denounce the crime. It is your place to seek the assassin. The young man's implacable eyes interrogated Vifor, who, on his side, glanced from Noirtier to Davrigny. But instead of finding sympathy in the eyes of the doctor and his father, he only saw an expression as inflexible as that of Maximilian. Yes, indicated the old man. Assuredly, said Davrigny. Sir, said Vifor, striving to struggle against this triple force and his own emotion. Sir, you are deceived. No one commits crimes here. I am stricken by fate. It is horrible indeed, but no one assassinates. The eyes of Noirtier lighted up with rage, and Davrigny prepared to speak. Morel, however, extended his arm and commanded silence. And I say that murders are committed here, said Morel, whose voice, though lower in tone, lost none of its terrible distinctness. I tell you that this is the fourth victim within the last 4 months. I tell you, Valentine's life was attempted by poison 4 days ago, though she escaped owing to the precautions of Monsieur Noirtier. I tell you that the dose has been doubled, the poison changed, and that this time it has succeeded. I tell you that you know these things as well as I do, since this gentleman has forewarned you, both as a doctor and a friend. Oh, you rave, sir, exclaimed Vifor, in vain endeavouring to escape the net in which he was taken.
I rave, said Morel. Well, then, I appeal to Monsieur Davrigny himself. Ask him, sir, if he recollects some words he uttered in the garden of this hotel on the night of Madame de Saint-Méran's death. You thought yourselves alone and talked about that tragical death, and the fatality you mentioned then is the same as that which has caused the murder of Valentine.
Vifor and Davrigny exchanged looks.
Yes, yes, continued Morel. Recall the scene, for the words you thought were only given to silence and solitude fell into my ears. Certainly, after witnessing the culpable indolence manifested by Monsieur de Vifor towards his own relations, I ought to have denounced him to the authorities. Then I should not have been an accomplice to thy death, as I now am, sweet, beloved Valentine. But the accomplice shall become the avenger. This fourth murder is apparent to all, and if thy father abandon thee, Valentine, it is I, and I swear it, that shall pursue the assassin.
And this time, as though nature had at last taken compassion on the vigorous frame, nearly bursting with its own strength, the words of Morel were stifled in his throat, his breast heaved, the tears, so long rebellious, gushed from his eyes, and he threw himself weeping on his knees by the side of the bed. Then Davrigny spoke.
And I too, he exclaimed in a low voice, I unite with Monsieur Morel in demanding justice for crime. My blood boils at the idea of having encouraged a murderer by my cowardly concession.
Oh, merciful heavens, murmured Vifor.
Morel raised his head, and reading the eyes of the old man, which gleamed with unnatural lustre, Stay, he said, Monsieur Noirtier wishes to speak.
Yes, indicated Noirtier, with an expression the more terrible from all his faculties being centred in his glance.
Do you know the assassin? Asked Morel.
Yes, replied Noirtier.
And will you direct us? Exclaimed the young man. Listen, Monsieur Davrigny, listen. Noirtier looked upon Morel with one of those melancholy smiles which had so often made Valentine happy, and thus fixed his attention. Then, having riveted the eyes of his interlocutor on his own, he glanced towards the door. "Do you wish me to leave?" said Morel sadly. "Yes," replied Noirtier. "Alas, alas, sir, have pity on me." The old man's eyes remained fixed on the door. "May I at least return?" asked Morel.
"Yes."
"Must I leave alone?"
"No."
"Who am I to take with me? Monsieur le Procureur du Roi?"
"No."
"The doctor?"
"Yes."
"You wish to remain alone with Monsieur de Villefort?"
"Yes."
"But can he understand you?"
"Yes."
"Oh," said Villefort, inexpressibly delighted to think the inquiries were to be made tête-à-tête.
"Oh, be satisfied, I can understand my father."
D'Avrigny took the young man's arm and led him out of the room. A more than death-like silence then reigned in the house. At the end of a quarter of an hour, a faltering footstep was heard, and Villefort appeared at the door of the apartment where D'Avrigny and Morel had been staying, one absorbed in meditation, the other in grief.
"You can come," he said, and led them back to Noirtier.
Morel looked attentively on Villefort. His face was livid, large drops rolled down his face, and in his fingers he held the fragments of a pen which he had torn to atoms.
"Gentlemen," he said in a hoarse voice, "give me your word of honour that this horrible secret shall for ever remain buried amongst ourselves."
The two men drew back.
"I entreat you," continued Villefort. "But," said Morel, "the culprit, the murderer, the assassin. Do not alarm yourself, sir. Justice will be done," said Villefort. "My father has revealed the culprit's name. My father thirsts for revenge as much as you do. Yet even he conjures you, as I do, to keep this secret. Do you not, father?"
"Yes," resolutely replied Noirtier.
Morel suffered an exclamation of horror and surprise to escape him.
"Oh, sir," said Villefort, arresting Maximilian by the arm, "if my father, the inflexible man, makes this request, it is because he knows, be assured, that Valentine will be terribly avenged. Is it not so, father?"
The old man made a sign in the affirmative. Villefort continued,
"He knows me, and I have pledged my word to him. Rest assured, gentlemen, that within 3 days, in a less time than justice would demand, the revenge I shall have taken for the murder of my child will be such as to make the boldest heart tremble."
And as he spoke these words, he ground his teeth and grasped the old man's senseless hand.
"Will this promise be fulfilled, Monsieur Noirtier?" asked Morel, while D'Avrigny looked inquiringly.
"Yes," replied Noirtier, with an expression of sinister joy.
"Swear, then," said Villefort, joining the hands of Morel and D'Avrigny, "swear that you will spare the honour of my house and leave me to avenge my child."
D'Avrigny turned round and uttered a very feeble, "Yes." But Morel, disengaging his hand, rushed to the bed, and after having pressed the cold lips of Valentine with his own, hurriedly left, uttering a long, deep groan of despair and anguish. We have before stated that all the servants had fled. Monsieur de Villefort was, therefore, obliged to request Monsieur d'Avrigny to superintend all those arrangements consequent upon a death in a large city, more especially a death under such suspicious circumstances. It was something terrible to witness the silent agony, the mute despair of Noirtier, whose tears silently rolled down his cheeks. Villefort retired to his study, and D'Avrigny left to summon the doctor of the mayoralty, whose office it is to examine bodies after decease, and who is expressively named the doctor of the dead. Monsieur Noirtier could not be persuaded to quit his grandchild. At the end of a quarter of an hour, Monsieur D'Avrigny returned with his associate. The district doctor approached the corpse with the indifference of a man accustomed to spend half his time amongst the dead. He then lifted the sheet which was placed over the face and just unclosed the lips. "Alas," said D'Avrigny, "she is indeed dead, poor child. You can leave."
"Yes,"
answered the doctor laconically, dropping the sheet he had raised. Noirtier uttered a kind of hoarse rattling sound. The old man's eyes sparkled